Welcome to the All Souls Forum here at KKFI. I'm your host, Christina Fraser, and tonight's conversation features Kansas City native Barbara Bickelmeyer, Provost for Academic Affairs at UMKC. Dr. Bickelmeyer holds a PhD in Educational Communications and Technology from the University of Kansas and previously served as Executive Associate Vice President for University Academic Affairs and Senior Director of the Office of Online Education at Indiana University in Bloomington. In tonight's talk, Dr. Bickelmeyer will discuss her vision of UMKC in the coming years. She will explain why she believes education isn't the great equalizer, but the great differentiator. She speaks not only from her professional experience in academia, but from her professional experience watching her own life and those of her 9 siblings play out over the years. Our show was recorded on December 11th at All Souls Universalist Unitarian Church here in Kansas City, Missouri. We will follow our usual format, beginning with our speaker's presentation, followed by a short break, and then we will conclude with the question and answer part of the program. Thanks for tuning into the show. Now let's join the conversation here at 90.1 FM KKFI.
We have with us today someone whom I have a great deal of respect for, and I'm going to talk about her in a gushy fashion, out of my own experience, because I think it's important that as many people as possible realize the opportunity that we have in Barbara Bickelmeyer. I won't talk too much about her roots in Shawnee, other than to say that my wife went to St. Joe Grade School and High School with a seemingly endless catalog of Bickelmeyers, and Barbara fit in there, and she can explain where. However, when I was in the Navy, the last job that I had was on the staff of the commander of the Submarine Force Atlantic Fleet. This was a vice admiral who was responsible for two-thirds of the nuclear submarines in the entire American inventory. And that job, I was a middle-grade staff officer. Not to see what it looked like to have the people who reported directly to the admiral and how they went about preparing themselves over the course of their careers to hold the jobs that they had on those staffs. And when I look at Barbara's resume, what I see is that same kind of long-term intentionality to provide a very broad set of perspectives with an eye in mind towards leading, and leading on a scale that can make a difference across the region like Kansas City. And so while she began her career and has done most of her degree gathering at the University of Kansas, she worked for Sprint. She ran a startup consulting firm. She worked in various adjunct faculty positions teaching, and eventually at Indiana University started working her way through a variety of positions related to learning how a big university operates. And so a year and a half ago, she was chosen to be the new provost, the chief academic officer at UMKC, and I can't imagine someone who could be better prepared for that. So now, a year and a half later, she's going to talk to us about what she's seen and where she hopes we're all going together. So I welcome Barbara Bickelmeyer.
Good morning, and thank you very much. And I want to thank Bill particularly. Thank you very much. So I have had the opportunity to work with Bill on some initiatives in Kansas City, and he is a great resource to me, and I'm honored that he has given me this opportunity and that you're here today. I also want to acknowledge one of my colleagues, Bonnie Postlethwaite, who's here and a member of your church, so she's going to keep me honest as I talk today. What Bill asked me to talk about is designing the 21st century university, particularly a public urban research university, which is what UMKC is. And he's correct that the reason I came home was because I had an opportunity at UMKC. I didn't come to UMKC because it brought me home. As he mentioned, I'm from a large family in western Kansas City in Shawnee. I'm the youngest of 10 children. And I take my work as an educator seriously because I was intrigued to read a quote when I was very early on in my profession by Horace Mann, who was the father of the common school model, the public K-12 school model that we use today. And Horace Mann said that education was the great equalizer. And being the youngest of 10 and looking at all my brothers and sisters and seeing how some of them were being successful in their lives and in their careers, and others were not able to establish all that they had hoped for in their families and their careers, it made me realize that education really isn't the great equalizer. Education is the great differentiator. And it certainly was for me. It was how I was able to become the individual that I aspired to be in a family of 10 people. And so my whole goal in my career has been to try to help others to have that opportunity to become the individuals that they aspire to be. And everything about our educational system makes that a reality or not a reality. So that's what I'm going to talk about a little bit today. And I'm going to talk about why higher education particularly is at a fundamental moment of transformation, probably the most foundational transformation that it's been in since its beginning. But to do that, I want to take you back for just a moment to the way, 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 way back. I want you to think about how people learned 10,000 years ago or 20,000 years ago, before there ever was a university anywhere in the Western Hemisphere, or before there ever was a common school, how people learned. We forget that in an era where we have SAT scores and ACT scores and standardized testing and large infrastructure. And we think that learning is something that has to happen or only happens in schools. But the truth be told, we're all capable of learning. We're all capable of learning. It's the basic element of evolution and adaptation. It's what we do. It's why we're here. So how did we do that when we didn't have universities and we didn't have K-12 schools? Throughout history, we learned, whether it was in caves with our family, pictographs saying that's an animal you avoid and that's an animal you eat, or whether it was Socrates in the courthouse square talking about and discussing and in dialogue very significant concepts about democracy that we're still talking about today and need to talk about even more, or whether it was in guilds where people were learning really sophisticated crafts such as metallurgy by mentoring and modeling. People have always been able to learn, and throughout most of history, they've learned just in time and just in place and just as needed. But in the West, some number of years ago, as the Roman Empire was crumbling and there were all these very rare and special artifacts of civilization that were on papyrus and vellum, which was hard to recreate, the Romans swept up all those materials, and if you believe the book, How the Irish Saved Civilization, what happened was all those were moved to Ireland, not all of them, that's a little hyperbole, but those really significant and special items were protected in a conservatory that literally had bridges and gates and moats. And so we started collecting the artifacts of civilization and holding them in a place and bringing people to curate those. And then people who wanted to know about those artifacts or learn about them or engage in scholarly discourse and dialogue came to those ivory towers with moats and gates. And what we got was the unintended consequence of the idea of the academy as a conservatory that was a gatekeeper. And our job was to keep the precious things in and keep the barbarians out. Now, lo these many years later, and again, there was a reason for that, but lo these many years later, if you paid attention to the newspapers, last year in the state of Missouri, it was an interesting year for higher education, particularly the University of Missouri system in Columbia, and of course UMKC is a sister campus. And one of the things that you might have heard about November 8th and November 9th, those are auspicious dates for me now, because last year when I was new in my position as provost, November 7th, 8th, and 9th were about conversations between students who represented Concerned Student 1950 and Black Lives Matter, and the president of the University of Missouri system and the chancellor of the Columbia campus. And the students in the University of Missouri system that weekend of November 6th, asked the president outside of the Kauffman Foundation while he was here at UMKC for a fundraising event, for our conservatory, they asked him, how do you define systematic oppression? And he had a challenging week, and he perhaps didn't answer that the way he might have answered it if he had been a little less tired, I'm sure. But it was a really important question. It was a really important question because actually a conservatory mentality that includes gatekeeping is systematic oppression. When we say there are people we let in and there are people we keep out, we're talking about some kind of gatekeeping matrix that those students were challenging. They were challenging and they were saying, we need higher education to work for a greater, a more diverse, a larger population of students than it has in the past. That's the story of the University of Missouri system. And interestingly, fast forward a year later, and November 8th and November 9th have different meanings for us in terms of an election. And I think we have to admit that whatever else happened there, there were some statements about how education is not really serving our country well. So what are we going to do about that? And that's a lot of what this story is about. It's again that idea, the unintended consequence of the idea of a conservatory as gatekeeper. There are people, there are students who are being left outside the gate, and they want in. And there are students who have been left outside the gates, or in the K-12 setting, have fallen through the cracks, a phrase we literally use to blame students. They fell through the cracks because they weren't motivated enough, or they weren't smart enough, or they weren't something enough. Instead of recognizing it's the system that's broken and not the student. So my question has been for about 30 years, what do we do about that? And I think that these things that are going on in our country is how the revolution begins, how higher education begins to change, how K-12 education begins to change. So the question is, how did that revolution come about? Why, and what's that change going to look like, and how do we make sure it's good for us? There are many pressures to change, and I'm going to talk about higher education particularly now, but there are many pressures to change in higher education right now, and I just want to point some of these out for you. First of all, the infrastructure of higher education has grown so huge that it is straining under its own weight. Again, if you went back to those first higher education institutions or those first conservatories, really, the point there was to have archives and to conserve artifacts and to have classrooms and spaces really where the curators or the faculty and the students could be in dialogue. But as time went on, you can imagine what happened. Then those students need a place to live, and then they need food, and then they need health care, and then they need a larger life, and then they need recreation, and they need climbing walls, and I guess they need football, and I guess they need, you know, so many other things. And universities have become mini cities in and of themselves. And that is an unbelievable cost. An unbelievable cost. So there's a huge infrastructure, and that was really okay for some time when, particularly for public institutions, there was a huge support mechanism in the state called state appropriations. But state appropriations have declined tremendously. I'll come back to that in a minute. We now have also shifting student demographics. In the age of the internet, in the information age, more students need higher education than ever needed it before. 100 years ago, prior to the GI Bill, prior to the information age, it was really only about the top 10% of our society that pursued higher education. That top 10% was either by socioeconomic status or people who were so brilliant that somebody said, I'm going to sponsor you because I think you can make a significant contribution to intellectual life in this country. And those students received scholarships. And they didn't have to worry about work because, number one, they weren't really paying for anything. And number two, most of them knew who was going to give them a job when they finished. And now, in the information age, all of a sudden people need higher education in order to be able to have a job just to maintain the middle class that their parents had. And they're having to pay for it. And so we have more students coming into higher education than ever before, with greater diversity of preparation than ever before, depending on how their school system works and how good it is, and their background. And so we have a much bigger burden in terms of the load that we have to bear, and we have shrinking revenues. There's only 5 sources of revenues in higher education: state appropriations if you're public, tuition, grant dollars for research, development, or fundraising dollars, and then other auxiliary services. And all of those are tapped or shrinking right now. And so the burden is becoming onto the student. Students are having to pay more. And because students are having to pay more than they ever had to pay before for higher education, they have calls for accountability. It makes sense. You can literally look at trend lines as tuition has gone up since state appropriations have dropped, and as socioeconomic level of students who are attending higher education has gone down. Just when you get about to the x-axis there, or where those two lines come together, you start hearing calls for accountability. What's the return on investment? What will I get? Why should I invest in this? Why should I delay gratification? Why should I not just go out and start working? Those are legitimate questions to ask when 50 or 75% of your family's annual income could potentially be caught up in paying your tuition. That is not a cost. That's an investment. And you need to know what's the return. And in higher education, we're not used to that because our faculty were the masters. You came to sit at the feet of the masters. We questioned you. You didn't question us. And so the roles are reversing. And in that mix, all of a sudden, there are all these new technologies that are influencing how we educate. And there are people who believe that with new technologies, we should be able to cut the cost curve tremendously. We should be able to offer online education free to anybody who wants it, and that would be adequate education. And we're trying to figure out what that means. And that's where my academic background and my skill set lies. I've been studying for 30 years how new technologies change the way we educate and how educational institutions are adapting those. So there's all these disruptive technologies, but people think that they're going to disrupt in a certain way, and that's not really at all what's happening. So I want to take a moment and talk just a little bit about the impact of the Internet on higher education, because if you understand this, then you'll see really where we need to go. And I'm not predicting here what this impact is. If you look closely at patterns, this is evident everywhere, but we don't typically see the whole. And the other point about looking at the impact of the Internet is you don't have to look too far back in history to understand a model for that, because the Internet is doing to higher education right now what it did to the publishing sector and the recording sector and the information sector and libraries about 15 years or so ago or 10 years or so ago. And we're just starting to see the impact of that right now. So these are not really predictions. These are just pattern watching. So the first thing is, how many of you guys use Google? How many of you guys look at Wikipedia? Okay. The conservatory is moving to the cloud. The whole foundation of what higher education was built on is moving to the Internet. So what does that mean for fundamentally what we're supposed to be doing? That question alone changes what is our value added. That's Bonnie's responsibility in our university, and it's a hard job she's got to figure out what is a library, what's the infrastructure, what's the knowledge base for a university need to be now that the conservatory is moving to the cloud. And for that that's not moving to the cloud, it's becoming privatized. It costs more and more for the library to actually be able to provide the journals and the research access, because there are publishers who are holding on to that as their value added. So what does that mean for us? Then the question comes up of what is education? These people who think that a MOOC, I don't know if you've heard that phrase, it's massively online open course, or if online courses are going to be the future, that's a lot like correspondence courses. It's a lot like, you know, go teach yourself, here's some materials for you. Particularly young learners, particularly disadvantaged learners, first-generation college-going students, don't know how to do that. They're not going to be successful in that format. So what we're starting to learn is that really education is a sophisticated process, and it's not a great lecture. It's not dumping information. It's not sitting at the feet of the master. Education always has been and always will be increasing your capabilities so that you can do something today that you couldn't do before. Education, again, is the ability to do something today that you couldn't do before. So our job in higher education is not just to give a good lecture. Our job in higher education is to make sure that you have a knowledge base and skill set that allows you to do something that you couldn't do before. And so now we're having to think about, is that really how we're organized? Is that what we're delivering? Do we need to do things differently? Do we need to be more student-centered? Do we need to be more engaging? Those are really critical questions, because if you ever thought that higher education was all about good lectures, then you haven't heard about YouTube. Because students literally ask now, why should I show up to campus? I can watch that on YouTube. And it's even better than coming to campus, because in campus, I'm in a room with 1,000 people, and I'm way back there, and I can hardly see the professor. And on YouTube, I can see it right up close. I can pause, I can rewind, I can fast forward, I can hear it over again. YouTube is actually a better lecture than a lecture that they get in higher ed. And then you've got the question about what quality is. The interesting thing about higher education is we have a very uninformed consumerate. We actually have uninformed workers, because professors actually really aren't taught to teach. They're taught their knowledge base, and they develop their skills in their knowledge base. People think that great higher education is great because it costs a lot of money, or because the university is really old, or because it's private and it's got the name Harvard on it, or because this is the scariest thing of all. It's highly selective. Think about any other economic sector or enterprise where the way you judge quality is by how you don't serve. Because the idea of high-quality education being determined by the SAT scores of your students or by how many students you don't admit is saying and representing we value gatekeeping over bridge building. So we're learning that really quality education is interactivity, it's engagement, it's the experience of working with students to help them come to own their own learning and learn how to be responsible for their own learning and learn how to be in relationship with others who can mentor and partner. So that's entirely a different perspective than historically we've had about what education is. We're also, as a result of the internet, having to redefine what expertise is. Again, 30 or 40 or 50 years ago, expertise was what knowledge you have. It was what you knew. But now when the conservatory's in the cloud, I literally saw a bumper sticker a few weeks ago that said, why would I pay for my child to go to college when everything you teach he can get on the internet? If that's the perception, we have to help people understand that expertise is no longer what you know, it's what you do with what you know. And that means higher education literally has to reorganize. We have to get away from the idea that knowledge is expertise. And literally, we have departments of biology, we have departments of chemistry, and we have departments of philosophy, we have departments of education. And we have to think about how we deliver and say, maybe what we need to be delivering in our core is not philosophy or biology, it's thinking about the systems of the natural world, or about philosophical reasoning, or about critical thinking, or about quantitative reasoning, or about developing empathy and compassion. What are the skills that we need to instill in this future, as opposed to what's the knowledge? And then, the internet is forcing us to start to understand the connection between research and learning that we haven't understood previously. I have spent my last week a fair amount in St. Louis and in Jefferson City working with legislators and university leaders and system leaders to help try to re-educate the public and those who provide funding and support through state appropriations to higher ed to help them understand that research isn't this thing we do over here that doesn't matter, and teaching this other thing we do over here that really matters. Research is how faculty look at problems in the world and ask, how do we solve that problem? And if they can't find an answer that already exists, then they pose a question, they come up with a method, they collect data, they analyze it, they make a claim or recommendation about how to fix that, and they study it again, and they know the limitations. That's the activity of research. And what faculty need to do for students is to model how to research, how to ask a question, how to learn. Because everybody who's criticizing higher education says we're not preparing students adequately for this new world. They're saying they come out ill-prepared with skills, and they come out ill-prepared to know how to learn and to change and to grow. And yet the very ways that we teach students how to research and how to learn and grow, we're told are not very valued and valuable. So there's a disconnect, again, that goes back to the public not really understanding what it is we do, and that's our responsibility, and particularly my responsibility as provost, to help better educate the public about how research and learning come together. And then there's more data than we've ever had before about the learning enterprise that we can learn from, so we're starting to see what we're doing well and what we're not doing so well. And it really throws all of our past perceptions on the head about how learning occurs. And we have to rethink about how we deliver. But all that disruption is going on while there's also more and more aggressive competition than there ever has been in the past. There are universities sprouting up every day, for-profit, online. And again, because people don't know how to select a good university from a not-so-good university, they put their money there, and that takes away from the pool and the resources to do the good work that we need to do. And all that's going on while our infrastructure is disaggregating because all of these influences are meaning we have to do things differently. We have to organize differently. We have to figure out how to use our libraries differently. So there's a lot going on in higher ed. So how do we take all of that disruption and build something that's even better than it was before, that serves the 21st century needs better than the 15th century needs or the 3rd century needs that we have been serving in the infrastructure we've had for so long? So it has to do with thinking about how we better customize our programs and services. So let me talk about that a little bit and the idea of what I think the 21st century university looks like, particularly the public urban research university. First of all, we've got to understand that people are just generally capable of learning, and that unless you have some special need or some particular challenge, we're all capable of learning. And we have to move from that gatekeeping conservatory model where the privileged and special few had access to an educational experience and the barbarians were left outside the gates, to understanding that every mind in this society is precious. Every mind in this society is needed and valued. So everything that we do, we need to work on building bridges and changing our infrastructure to do that. A quick review of everything we've talked about. Okay, so bridges, not gates. And one important thing to think about in that is when we think about students failing, we think about they're too lazy, or they're not dedicated, or they're not smart enough. But I want to remind you that students today are sacrificing more to get a higher education experience than any students ever in the history of the world. And I mean, that's not an exaggeration. They're spending more of their family income, they're working harder, they're trying to make this opportunity available to them. So it's the system and the preparation that is failing. It's not the student. In every other sector of society right now, the internet has moved the expectation of consumers and clients and customers to customization, to personalization. I can go online and order a computer from Apple to my specifications. If I want to pay for it, I can have it built in China that day, put on a UPS plane, and delivered to me within 48 hours. If I want to take my family to Disney World, I can go online and I can figure out exactly which rides I want to be on when. I can have food delivered to me in the line while I'm waiting, or I can get the fast pass and go beyond the line. I can go to Amazon and I can look at books, and it will tell me other books like the books that I have. that I might be interested in reading. Everywhere a consumer goes today, they get an experience of personalization based on big data and based on what the internet can tell us about their experience. And the one place that should be personalized, the one place that should be personalized is the educational experience. And it's the least personal experience they have. So we have to redesign our systems to provide mass customization, to help students have as flexible of a learning opportunity as they possibly can. We still have to hold our standards. We still have to expect quality. But we have to be more flexible in how we deliver it. We have to be more student-oriented and more personalized in what we do. We have to change our entire systems to make that possible. And we have to remember that the kind of experience we're building for students must be highly engaging. And that's really not new. It's just we're finally getting clarity. Again, that the great educational experience is not the great lecture. A great lecture is wonderful. It's part of it, but it's not all of it. And we have to focus on that deep engagement, that high engagement, those high impact personalized learning experiences for students. We have to do that in a way that is reminiscent of what Steve Jobs said to Walter Isaacson as Isaacson was interviewing him and working with him to write his biography about Steve Jobs. Isaacson asked Steve Jobs what he attributed the success of Apple Computer to. And Jobs basically said, I understand that people want to listen to music, and they want to read books, and they want to see photos, and they want to connect with their family. They don't want to push Control-Alt-Delete. My job is to get the infrastructure out of the way, and that's what I try to do with Apple. Our computers, our technology, get the infrastructure out of the way so people can do the really important things they want to do. And I think that's higher education's a big challenge right now, is getting our infrastructure out of the way so we help students learn. And we're going to do that using big data in ways we've never had data before about higher education. We've never had data about our retention rates, and we've never had data about early alert systems and who's not turning in their assignments and who is. We've never really taught faculty how to work with that kind of information. So that means really, ultimately, one of the things that we have to do is help the professorate, help faculty to do their jobs better. Every innovation I see in higher education is really trying to work around faculty. They don't want to deal with tenure. They don't want to deal with shared governance. They don't want to deal with these people who can't lose their jobs, and they're nervous about that. But the truth is, the only way we're going to make these kind of changes in higher education, to create the kind of university that our students need, that our city needs, that our country needs, is to work with faculty to do a few things. First of all, we have to remember they are the standard bearers. Their job is to hold a standard. You wouldn't want a nurse who didn't really master the skills that a nurse needs to be able to do on the job. You wouldn't want a doctor. You wouldn't want a dentist. You wouldn't want a pharmacist. All programs we have at UMKC. You wouldn't want an engineer. You wouldn't want a lawyer. You wouldn't want a teacher. You wouldn't want a philosopher who hadn't mastered the standards of their profession. But in order to start building that bridge, they have to hold the standard, but they have to be the model learner. They have to work with students to help students understand, here's how you become an expert. Here's how you learn to meet that standard. And they do that by being bridge builders. They go back and they reach the student where the student is. A student wouldn't come to us if they were already at mastery. They come to us because they know they want that thing in the future. They're willing to delay more gratification than for anything else they do in their lives. One of my favorite stories, just to make that point, is I had great privilege to work with wonderful students over the course of my time on faculty at Indiana University, where I came from. And one student particularly who I'm very close to, and she was working on her dissertation, and her dissertation took a long time. It took her about 6 years to do this. And she had a lot of data to collect. Over the course of that 6 years, she decided that she wanted an internship, and so she worked. She got a job at Eli Lilly. She got married. She had her first child. A first child always motivates you to get your dissertation done. So I went to stop by her house and visit her as she was finalizing her dissertation. And she'd had her baby, and I hadn't seen her baby yet. And I went and I said, Simone, and I knocked at the door, she left me, and I said, Simone, where's your baby? I want to see your baby. And she said, Dr. B, here's my dissertation. And I said, Simone, I want to see your baby. And she said, Dr. B, here's my dissertation. And I said, Simone, I want to see your baby. And she said, Dr. B, my baby only took 9 months. This dissertation took 6 years. You are going to see this dissertation, and you're not going to see my baby. I said, okay. It's a really important point, though, because it says something about what students put into this process, the delay of gratification, the hard work, the thankless work, and we have to be better about supporting them along the way in ways we haven't. I'm sure you might have heard what I heard when I was in college. Look to the left, look to the right, somebody's not going to be here at the end. We can't afford that anymore. We have to help faculty to understand, in order to be bridge builders, their job is to be critical thinkers. I'm convinced over the course of my tenure in higher education, the work that I've done as an administrator, that sometimes faculty, particularly as they move through their career, they start to confuse critical thinking with a critical spirit. And we have to help remind them. We need all the critical thinking you can provide, but you have to do it with some kind of rational optimism and faith in people and belief in teams. They have to be truth tellers. They have to actually value facts and knowledge. We really need that right now in this country. And they have to know they're accountable. They have to know that this work is stewardship and service, that it has an impact. This is what makes our work public. And finally, they have to do it in a way where they work with others. These are all things that faculty really are just assumed to do and have not historically been supported to do. It's strange when you think about higher education and the fact that faculty really aren't taught to teach. Again, they're taught their disciplinary area. They're not really taught to research, except for the one way they do research in their disciplinary area. They're not really taught how to manage or to lead. No other multi-billion-dollar organization would do that. That was one of the beauties of my experience at Sprint. I was responsible for the management curriculum as they were building Sprint. Sprint was investing so many dollars in their management. And I came to higher ed and I looked around and I said, where is it? It isn't there. Fundamentally, I think that's what makes higher education in the future a learning organization rather than a knowledge organization. We think about higher ed as about knowledge dissemination, knowledge creation, knowledge application. Higher ed is the most human-centric enterprise that there is, because it's where people come to grow and change, and where faculty on a daily basis grow and change. We have to remember that higher ed is about humans, and it's human-centric. And when we do that, I believe we will create the kind of public urban research university that we need to be at UMKC, and that UMKC can be a model for the rest of the country about what really matters and what value there really is in the enterprise of education. Thank you very much for listening to me today.
You are listening to the All Souls Forum on 90.1 FM KKFI. Let's take a short break and return to questions.
Going back a year or so ago, approximately, when there were protest demonstrations at Columbia, but also some focus at UNKC, it appeared that there was at that time, and there continues to be, a concern about a lack of cohesiveness between students, and certainly all of that could not be blamed on college atmosphere, with our society being divided in many ways. But what do you feel that colleges, particularly those that are more commuter-centered colleges, can do to promote cohesiveness and social skills between students?
That second point, to promote cohesiveness and social skills between students, is really, really important. And I think my understanding of what happened last fall really has been significantly informed by watching what happened this fall. And I think that point about what are social skills in the era of the internet, what some things that we've learned this past fall is that people are in their channels, right? And people hear from and relate to and connect with people who think just like they think. And they don't really even realize that there's a whole other conversation occurring. So that's one part. Two, they don't really know anymore what's real and what's not real. I've heard, but I haven't seen this document anywhere, that the word for 2016 is post-factual. Again, I'll point over to Bonnie. Bonnie, in her role at UMKC, works with our general education curriculum to provide information literacy. It's scary when we're in our channels, first of all, when we can't tell fact from fiction, and maybe we don't even value fact from fiction or understand why fact is important. And then third, when we're confronted with facts from people who think differently than we do and have different value systems than we do, we don't know how to engage in conversation. We know how to tweet about it. We know how to text about it. And I will tell you, in my own personal story this past 6 weeks, I'm convicted of that a little bit myself. We don't know how to communicate very well anymore in a respectful, dialogical way to talk about how we think differently. So I think part of the cohesiveness we have to build is to learn how do we agree to disagree respectfully, and over what will we agree to disagree, and how do we come together again on what we value as American citizens in a democratic republic. So I think only higher ed really is poised to do that work in a systemic and systematic way. So I think all of those pieces come together, and it's why we have to recognize our society is fundamentally different than it was 50 years ago. And the skills that people need to be in relationship with each other are fundamentally different than they were 50 years ago. And we need to build the infrastructure and the programs to deliver those skills. And we need to remind ourselves of what it means to be citizens in a democratic republic. And I think all of that is the complexity of what we deal with. So it's not only to bring cohesion around what we value in this country, but it's also to bring skills to address that cohesion in a way that's respectful. Thank you for asking.
You had a list up there of qualities and skills that you would like your faculty to have. How have you figured out that you can help them do that?
Which, that's a wonderful question, and there's a couple answers. And let me say, in all of my conversations with faculty at UMKC, they have been the most respectful and reasonable and willing participants in talking about these kind of changes of any group that I've talked with, because they know they need it. The first thing is, again, UMKC, historically, we've had one really dedicated person overseeing what very little we do for faculty development. So when I spoke to the chancellor about coming to UMKC, I said, I will take on this challenge. I want commitment for two things. I want this to be a data-driven and developmental organization. So we're building our data enterprise, and we're building our development organization for faculty. So we're working on creating a center for research, learning, and teaching that hasn't been at UMKC before. We're working on figuring out what programs and what development experiences we need to provide faculty. Some of it has to do with teaching and learning. Some of it has to do with supporting research, because that's so valuable. Some of it has to do with helping department chairs gain skills and learn what it means to manage. Because, again, any other multi-million-dollar organization would already be delivering that. But at UMKC and at other institutions of higher education, that's just not historically what we've done. So programming and support, and then I think the third thing is to have organizational roles that allow faculty to be able to be part of the administration of the university in a more natural and organic way than they have historically. So those are the few things that we're starting to work on. Thank you for asking. Yes, ma'am.
Along with that, I'd like to ask what your opinion is of tenure
That's a great question. And actually, I was having this conversation just this past week around jurors' meetings in St. Louis. Tenure is to support academic freedom. And we are particularly in a moment in history where we need to value truth and its pursuit. Some truths that faculty need to study and explore are so highly political that they are threatened. So I think when we use tenure for the right reasons, which is what the AAUP says, I think that it is a critically important aspect of the pursuit of truth. Now, the problem with tenure is its abuse. And again, one of the things that's going on in the University of Missouri system, and I appreciate my colleague provost at other institutions, and I appreciate the faculty who have taken a lead on this, we're relooking at how we're organized to assure that abuse of tenure doesn't occur, and what faculty standard of conduct needs to be in place, and how we monitor and hold ourselves accountable. Again, we're coming out of a model of higher education that has been the conservatory and all of those things that I said about it, the gatekeeping, and it has been a model where the faculty are the experts and everybody else comes and sits at the feet of the masters. And so for faculty to re-envision what does it mean to hold ourselves accountable so that if we abuse tenure in some way, we take care of it, that's a new question for us. But I am impressed and respectful and heartened by faculty in the University of Missouri system who are finding what their standard of conduct will be so that they can work with administration. So it's a long story short. I think there's an important place for tenure. I think there are many reasons it has been abused, and I think faculty recognize that. And as a guild of scholars, they're finding the answer to make sure that doesn't happen. Thanks. Yes, sir.
Yeah, thank you for your presentation. It was very informative. As a young millennial, I guess you could say, my question is in regards to making college more applicable to the real world. With a lot of the election talk about people trying to provide free college and more people trying to go to college as saying that that's now the standard, that you need to have the lowest education, you need to have a base position besides a lot of blue-collar work, do you think we should differentiate between maybe the sort of programs where people go to community college to become a more globalized, aware citizen mm-hmm. and establish that education, and then another route in which we have people who are going for more specialized jobs once they figure out what they want to do with their life, since so many people change their majors 4 to 5 times during their four-year career. I'd love to get your take on that.
We do not have enough moments for me to say all that I would like to say about that. I think what you're asking is, if I were going to summarize it in a way that I'm going to answer it, whether you meant it or not, is with college being so expensive and more people needing it, how do we make it more flexible? How do we make paths forward for students? So is that a fair... Okay. So to that end, I think this goes to that idea of disaggregating and unbundling what it is we're doing. And there are many things that we're talking about in the University of Missouri, Kansas City, that we're working on with our sister campuses in the UM system. And actually, one of the things I've been doing this past fall is the state of Missouri is rethinking the structure of its higher education system and if it's aligned right. Behind that is, how do we better work together to create stackable credentials so that you can build some credential and immediately be able to get a good job for that and then build a further credential and move your way up as you move through, and to do that in a way where you don't have the messiness and the churn and the waste, so that you're not taking additional credit hours that don't end up counting in another university, and that you can get those programs in a way that is as flexible for you. So the idea of blended learning, I don't think that, honestly, the answer to particularly undergraduate experience is going to be in fully online programs. But I think blended programs, where we do understand the students shouldn't be showing up to class on campus for a lecture that they can watch on YouTube, when they get to campus, they should be highly engaged in dialogue with other students, in projects, working with faculty to get practical experiences and get a lot of feedback. That's that part I'm talking about, engagement. So I think there are a number of instructional approaches and interventions and initiatives that we've got that create greater flexibility. But we have to do it, again, that quote from Steve Jobs, is really relevant here, because what it means is we have to design our educational experience with the student in mind. And we have a lot to do on that. So thank you for asking. Yes, sir.
Excellent presentation. I appreciated your explanation about how the current higher education system is straining under its own weight and how the costs are increasing and the revenue is decreasing and so forth. But I wasn't quite clear on how you would propose solving this problem. And I'm looking at it from sort of a bottom line view of the consumer student who can't afford the tuition anymore. You're proposing the quality education be more high touch, be more customized, which implies to me greater costs. So how do we get around this issue where the system is creaking under its own weight? How do we make it affordable again?
I think there are several answers to that. The first of all is we remember our priorities and we focus on our academic core. Secondly, we look at administratively doing better with shared service. And I've had lots of conversations with faculty and with deans and with administrators at UMKC to talk about the fact that we can't afford to be siloed in basic services anymore, and that is also in the UM system. The president designate, Moon Choi, was just on our campus, I think, last week, and was also expressing that understanding that we have to look at our infrastructure, whether it's information technology, and primarily information technology, which costs us tens of millions of dollars a year within the system. How do we make sure our systems are aligned? How do we make sure that when we do shared work where we bring all our recruiters together, for example, or where we have all our advisors come together and work together to support students, that we're providing the service that our academic units need, but that we're doing the best that we can do to steward the use of our dollars so that we don't have replication work or rework or work around that we just really haven't paid attention to in the past in higher education because we haven't thought about ourselves as an economic enterprise. There is a fundamental conversation that goes on in higher ed and with the public, particularly in the era of constrained resources. We ask the question if higher education is a business or not a business. And faculty, rightly so, chafe at the idea of thinking about higher education as a business because it's so much more than that. It's a vocation. It's a passion. These are brilliant people who could do probably any work that they want to do and probably make 3 to 4 times more money than they're making for less hours a week. They're here because it's a vocation for them. So I understand why they hate the idea of talking about it as a business. Yet, it is a massive multi-million-dollar economic enterprise. So when I talk to faculty, I talk about the fact that we're an economic enterprise and we have to be good stewards of those dollars and we have to think about how we spend them and what we invest in and what our priorities are. But we have to understand that we are the anti-business in that business uses people to make money and higher education uses money to make people. And that is why it's sacred work.
You get the last question.
Okay.
Terrific big picture with lots of useful details. Thank you very much. You mentioned the failure of higher education to train its managers, department heads, etc. What is happening as far as universities or UMKC particularly in training, management training for managers?
Great. And again, this is, I think, something that is not just unique to UMKC, all institutions of higher education are recognizing this. I do think I had the great good fortune of having had an opportunity to work in a large organization such as Sprint as it was forming and be involved in their management curriculum. Some things that we're personally doing that I think will be models for higher education as we put these pieces in place is one, just a basic performance-oriented faculty handbook and a department chair handbook about. And I meet with department chairs on a monthly basis. I'm trying to move those to performance-based conversations. First of all, to alert department chairs to the fundamental accountabilities that we have to our accrediting bodies and to the state and to our system so that they're aware of what those accountabilities are. Two, what do they have to do to document clearly what do you have to do to meet those accountabilities and to make sure that we have the resources and supports to deliver on that. So that's part of the development. and it would seem strange to anybody who was outside of education. In any other kind of large organization, you would say, what do you mean a faculty handbook or a department chair handbook? How can you not have that? But again, it comes from this very historic perspective of being a guild of scholars, and that was what we did. And so when I talk about professionalizing the organization, it has to do with putting in place mechanisms that just simply haven't existed because of what we thought we were in the past and what we're changing to do. So quite a bit of it is just documentation for baseline accountabilities, making sure we have the resources to support and deliver those to department chairs and the faculty, and to develop opportunities for them to learn more about it. But again, that's cost shifting. That's cost shifting, because one reason we haven't had that is because our dollars have been in supporting students, and our dollars have been in supporting the research enterprise, and our dollars have been in doing all those things that, if it didn't meet the needs of a student, or if it didn't actually help promote our research infrastructure, we couldn't afford that.
Barbara, so, I think we can safely say you've whet our appetite for future discussions on this subject.